Hello and welcome back once again to the Railway Mania podcast. This episode is one that has been a long time in the works and in fact was on my wish list of interviews when I originally started planning the podcast. Our guest is Jonathan Gilbert, also known as Gandhi Dancer Productions on YouTube, and his work on documenting the last days of working steam traction in Britain is, in my opinion, second to none. In 2021, Jonathan was kind enough to let me pop round and talk to him about how these films came to be made and how they wound up being available to watch on YouTube. Here's the interview. Jonathan, welcome to the Railway Mania podcast.
Thanks very much, Gerwin. Good to be here.
It's great to be actually doing a record in person rather than, you know, online for once.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The 2 hours we've already spent talking about all sorts of things under the sun.
Yeah. I was trying not to spoil all the answers for myself.
It's always a problem.
So for anybody who doesn't know of your online presence, could you explain a bit about your YouTube channel, what it's called and what's on it?
Yeah. Well, it's Gandhi Dancer Productions. That's G-A-N-D-Y Dancer, D-A-N-C-R Productions, which is rather a mouthful. The reason it's called that is I took it from my company name in the US, which was a play on the guys, the section men who actually repaired and leveled the track were called Gandhi Dancers in America. This is on the main line in America. And the reason they were called Gandhi Dancers was because they used tools from a company called Gandhi in Chicago. And they used to sing, and when they pulled the track over, they'd do it in unison and use the beats of the songs they were singing. You've probably seen the movies of it. So they were called Gandhi Dancers.
I did not know that's where the name came from. I always knew it as it's the nickname for the pump trolley that Backman sell. It's called the Gandhi Dancer, but it must be because of the trackman.
Well, yeah, because they used it. They used those pump trolleys to get around on.
Gosh, I've already learned something today. This is great. We're off to a flying start. So what's on your YouTube channel?
It's a combination of model trains and big steam trains. It's a, I'm really, from my interest in steam trains, I wanted to recreate that for myself. So I started building model steam trains. And these are real model steam trains, as you can see on the channel. The channel started when I had just finished Blanche, the little 040. And I sat down. I sat down in front of my camera and just explained to the camera what it was all about and what this engine was and what it meant and a little bit of history of it. And I then looked back on it then and went, oh, this could be a YouTube video. So that's what started me up. So I went into my basement with my compressor airline and I talked about this little engine and ran it on the compressed air. And that started getting a lot of hits. So I then thought, oh, well, maybe construction. At the same time, I also have this quantity of 8mm film, which I'd shot in the late 1960s and early 1970s on steam locomotives, which were dying out fast at that time. And I had found a process with laser graphics with a guy in Boston, which I was living quite close to, which had this wonderful scanner and could get all the information out of the 8mm film. And it became viable to use that film on YouTube, to use that film on a computer. But what is really great about that is you can put sound onto it, which is sound that wasn't there before. And that's through nonlinear editing.
And so that spawned the Astley Green and Walkden Colliery Railway series, which is how I found your channel. So if we rewind a bit and we go back, so where did your interest in railways come from?
I mean, lost in time, really. I think it came from... my mum used to tell this story that when I was a two-year-old, I used to insist upon her taking me down to this place where a local freight train would shunt wagons, coal wagons for ICI, which was the big chemical company. And I'd insist upon going down there in the afternoon to watch this. I don't remember it because I was too young. You know, I was a young guy in the 1950s when it was all the railways were all steam. And so holidays, going out to see my auntie in Greenfield was all on a steam train. When you were out playing, you were usually out near a train track, and every now and again you'd stop and watch the steam train go by. And these were awe-inspiring machines. They were incredible. If you could get close to them as a young kid, and occasionally you could at the sidings, I mean, it was just such a thrill to see this massive machine, the smells, the sort of the glance of heat as it goes past, and that noise. Mm. There's nothing quite like the chuff of a steam engine.
I think I remember the first time that I saw a steam loco, not from platform level, but from ground level. And you just get this, because you're only a little kid at the time. So you just get this huge hulking great thing. It's like breathing smoke and making noise and things like that. It's just a sensory overload kind of thing.
Yeah. And I remember very clearly we came back. It was a Saturday evening and as a family, we'd come back into Manchester, Victoria, and from a trip out to my auntie who lived in Greenfield, the one I mentioned earlier. And as we walked past, I'm pretty sure it was a Black 5. And I was looking at the loco. The crew invited me up onto the footplate. I mean, it was awe-inspiring. Just the firebox door was open, and this roaring fire was inside.
And the heat.
The heat from it, and the smell from it. And these were my heroes. Mm. The driver and the fireman were my heroes. I mean, I'd been hanging my head out the window all the way back from Greenfield to Manchester, and that was a big turning point for me. The other thing was that, as I said again, railways were very accessible in those days. I could go down to Newton Heath Engine Shed on a Saturday morning. I'd go to the office there and say to the guy behind the counter, because he had a counter where the crew signed in, and say, can I have a look around the shed? He'd say, yeah, just make sure you come back and make sure so I can see that you've left. And I'd be in amongst 50 or 60 steam locomotives coming in on shed for the weekend.
What age were you at this time?
I was 14. On my own. They'd be coming in onto the ash pit. They'd be recoaling them. They'd be rewatering them and then putting them onto shed. There was junk around all over the place. There were pits to fall into. There were locomotives in steam. And when I got onto the shed, there'd probably be maybe 15 to 20 other little kids like me wandering around the shed. It was a Saturday afternoon's entertainment.
And what did the crews feel like about you observing them in their working environment?
No problem at all. No problem at all.
Did they enjoy it?
I think they enjoyed, by that time, that was sort of like 1963, 64. The writing was very much on the wall by then. So they could see that it was a dying business that they were in. And I think the recognition they quite enjoyed. I think they were very dedicated, those crews, because the environment was pretty, it was getting more and more appalling at that time. It was getting, the engines were getting dirtier. Mm. The maintenance was very, very poor, getting poorer. So I think they enjoyed that. As long as you didn't put stones on the track and try to derail the engine, I think they were just happy with you being around. They didn't care.
I remember hearing in an audiobook about how they were raining back on cleaners, which meant that crews could get promotion faster, but it meant that everything was filthy at that time.
I don't remember seeing many clean locomotives. The only time you saw a clean locomotive was when it was sort of... I remember seeing one very clean at Manchester Exchange, which was a reserve locomotive for a royal train.
Mm.
And if they'd come off, when we used to go down to North Wales for a camping holiday, we used to stop off at Shrewsbury. And that used to be a place where a crew used to send its engines for running in on. And you'd see a Black 5 or something like that in absolutely spotless condition. That was the only time, really, I ever saw clean locomotives. There were a number of other clean locomotives towards the end, because some of the enthusiasts used to go on shed in the night and clean one side of the locomotive. And the side that they were going to photograph. So you've got these peculiar looking locomotives, half clean and half dirty.
That's great. How did you get into filmmaking about railways? So what path did you take from then?
I realised that I wanted to capture that emotion and that enthusiasm, that excitement and that awe. And one way of doing that was through photography. So I used to borrow my dad's Voigtlander camera and go down to Newton's shed and take pictures with that. But I was really yearning to get movies, because I used to have one of those little movie things that kids had, which had a bit of a loop of film that used to wind through. And I was fascinated with the idea of still pictures becoming a moving picture. A neighbour was cascading a camera down because he'd bought a better movie camera, and he gave me his Clockwork camera. And these were at the times when Standard 8 was changing over to Super 8, so they were fairly cheap, the Standard 8 cameras. And that's how I got filming with it. And he was also instrumental in terms of getting me in touch with Astley Green, because later on they moved to Astley Green. They were just neighbours across the road in Cheetham Hill from where I used to live. They moved to Astley Green. I didn't know anything about the colliery being there at that time. And steam had finished on the main line. And you've got to remember, this is before the internet, so the sort of news network was not around where you could find out what was going on.
And I guess a lot of these things are operating almost behind closed doors. It's not like a public attraction. It's an industry that's just going about its daily business.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm.
And they mentioned to me that this colliery, which was literally 300-400 yards down the road from where they lived, which was hidden behind some other houses, may have a steam engine. And that was my affair with Astley Green started. And by that time, I had my better camera. I had my Shinon Concorde B. And I started filming at Astley Green. And I really kind of cut my teeth. So my photography and my television career was very much in sync with steam locomotives. It was almost the same thing. And my love of cameras and my love, film cameras, by the way, my love of film cameras and my love of steam engines was very similar. They were very tactile things.
Am I right in thinking that this was mostly self-taught? You weren't studying film at the time?
No, I never studied film.
What were you doing?
Oh, at that time I was still at school. I left school at 16. I think that was 67. And I became an apprentice on a power station.
So quite different then?
Quite different. Mm. And it was a thing also that you didn't really talk about because it was a bit strange, especially in North Manchester.
Well, it's quite different now. I mean, with the BBC moving to Salford and stuff now, it's almost gone full circle.
It has, yes.
Or complete opposites, you could say. At what point did you realise that you had to capture this moment?
Oh, it was certainly 1966 was when things started to really fall apart.
So at this point, we've seen, you know, steam was wiped out in the Western region by that point.
Yeah, Southern region was about to get rid of its steam coming out of Waterloo. Never managed to get down there. I was too young to get down there. Manchester, Victoria was still really a great hotspot for steam. And there was a thing that happened. There was a seaman strike. I can't find any references to it now, but there was a seaman strike that meant a lot more freight went onto the railways for about 2 weeks. And Manchester, Victoria was the most amazing place during that time. Because Manchester, Victoria, they had to have banking engines there because they had a 1 in 50 going up towards Miles Platting. So you always had at least two banking engines waiting in the station.
Wow.
You had freights coming through. There was a lot of coal traffic coming out of the Yorkshire coalfield. And they would come to a halt just underneath the road bridge, and then a banker would go on to the back of it, and then you'd have this big startup. Sometimes they'd start a bank train right the way back in Manchester Exchange, which was even more exciting because you were stood right by the side of the locomotive as it started up, and they really thrashed them to get up that bank.
Yeah. So we go back a bit. So you were working in a power station at the time, which was a respectable job, you could say, whereas the filmmaking seemed a bit left field at the time. How did you then transition into making films for a living?
Luck, mainly. I was a student apprentice with the CGB, which meant CGB, Central Electricity Generating Board. That meant I was doing 6 months on the station and 6 months at college. I got enough credits at college to get to university. Not the best university in the world, but get to university. That was Salford University, to do a degree in electrical engineering science. And I discovered there they had an art department, which had a couple of 16mm cameras and a Steenbeck editing machine. And I was just fascinated by this. I wanted to go that route. I wanted to shoot 16 rather than 8mm. You've got to remember, in those days, 8mm, you could just show it at home. There was no other means of exhibiting it in any way. And I managed to persuade them to loan me the gear, and I started shooting the daystand left.
Well, if you contextualise for people, the daystand left is actually one of the names of the videos on your YouTube channel that you can see now. But this was also the name that you gave to the short film that you made at the time.
That's correct. Astley Green had closed down in 1970. So in 1972, I was looking for a project with a steam engine, and one that was close to my house as well. YD Papers, Yates, Duxbury and Sons. They had two Pecketts and one Andrew Barclay steam locomotive running between the mills. And it seemed a great sort of confined, small project that wouldn't use a lot of footage that I could afford to make on 16mm. So I shot that. I did my degree. By the time I'd finished my degree, I'd finished that film, and I took it around and got a job at Granada Television as a trainee as a consequence of making that film, and I didn't look back. I wasn't going to go back onto the power stations.
Yeah, that's great.
One of the drawbacks of the career was that because of unionization, it was a long time before I was allowed to actually hold a camera. Even when I became a director in television, I always had a film crew with me. And really, I was as much a photographer as I was a director. And it wasn't until the system started to break down in 1989, 1990, when the unions lost a little bit more control, and I did a project for the BBC, that I started filming again, actually shooting and directing, which was magic.
But fast forwarding now to the time that you started making videos, you're living in America, so you're making your sort of career. Well, furthering your career in the States.
Yeah, that was later. That was 93 when I left for America, and took the family over there, and we lived there, and and I made films in America. The whole TV industry, which was changing dramatically in the UK. Consequently, there weren't, for independent filmmakers like myself, there weren't that many jobs around, or more jobs in America.
For the purpose of this podcast, that was quite fortunate, because in America, that's where you met this person who was able to digitize those films that you'd taken back in 1968.
Yeah, that was much later, though. That was in, you know, that was only in 2017, 2018. He'd opened this business up in Boston. I'd given quite a few of the films over to the Northwest Film Archives, which is now part of Manchester University, but they had a really crap telecine. And it didn't, it was like all the other horrible 8mm films that you've seen on YouTube. And I was really disappointed. So I called those films back. I got them back from the archive there. I was scouting around and scouting around. And really, it was the digital revolution in 2013 when you got sensors which had all that detail in them. There was just one sensor rather than three sensors for the three colors that started to allow the real quality of film to come through. Plus the fact that they were, you know, they didn't register off the sprocket holes. It registers off the frame line, so you get a much steadier picture. It doesn't grip the film in any way. The film is just in a little valley that it runs through. It's an amazing machine.
A lot of people may have seen the kind of 8mm films that you're talking about, and the footage is often very jumpy. There's a lot of flashes, a lot of dust and hair. So is that the kind of stuff that you're talking about? What you wanted to avoid.
Exactly, yeah. You know, you needed the colour depth. A lot of 8mm films, and the blacks are really solid black. And you think that's the film stock, but it isn't. It's the means of which you're transferring, and there's a lot of detail in the blacks. So I transferred these 8mm films at 2K, and they used ProRes 8HQ, which is a 422 color depth. Plus they do two scans of the images it goes through, so they vary the exposure on the frame. I mean, they look crap when you actually look at them coming raw off the back of the laser graphic scanner, because they've compressed, they brought up the darks and
so the color space is almost like log space, where everything looks washed out and milky. I think we usually call it milky, so it looks like you're looking at it through a layer of milk.
Yeah. And also they don't do any color correcting while transferring, so that the bright, they run down to the brightest part of the picture, which is probably the clouds in the sky. So everything's pressed from the top and everything's pressed from the bottom. So if you look at it on your oscilloscope, your scope, you'll see there's quite a bit of space top and bottom. And then I put it into color correction, spread that out. I mean, some of the film stock, especially I used to use, because I was so cheap, I used to use Ilford color, which was, it was about half the price of Kodachrome. And it was very grainy, and the color would move around all over the place. By watching the scopes and the three color channels, I can bring a lot back out of that film. The grain I can't get. I don't mind the grain actually quite so much. Kodachrome is an amazing stock. It has a huge range in it. I mean, it's astonishing. I didn't realize until I started looking at these films of mine and after the transfers, just what exposure depth it has. And it's almost like negative film stock. The other thing is that I didn't keep my films in a particular environment. You know, it's all room temperature, but it wasn't special, and they've all held up so well. I pity our digital guys now that I think that the preserving digital pictures is a problem.
Well, there's some people saying we're actually living in an information dark age because it's all digitized and kept on servers, and, you know, that could easily be lost at some point. There's no physical storage facility for them unless you're storing it on, say, magnetic tapes or anything else like that. So there might be a huge loss of data from the era that we're living through at the moment.
I think that's a big deal, yeah. I think that's a very big deal. I think that we don't realize, you know, it's not just, the cloud going down, but if you've had a computer for more than 10 years, you realize that the codecs have changed, the hard drives have changed, the software's changed to drive the hard drives. It's a pain, actually, all of that stuff. And, hard drives are open to corruption. If I chose to transfer my files at 4K, as you well know, being in the business, you've got huge files. You've got to back those up. You need a lot. I've got a filing cabinet there full of hard drives. But it just shows you just how cumbersome the process comes when you get into the cutting room with it.
Definitely. And it's really interesting to think about that in terms of the image and video saturation that we see online. And you think, well, there's no way any of this can disappear because there's so much of it. But actually, it almost makes it more likely to disappear because it's so disposable.
Yeah, and who knows whether Google and YouTube are going to be around in 20 years' time. They're already kind of threatening that if you're not getting a certain audience, they'll pull them after a certain amount of time, your videos. Because, God, I mean, how many servers has YouTube got?
Yeah, it's exactly that. And so going back to the films that you'd taken, obviously these were able to sit in your cupboard for Decades.
50 years.
50 years, and able to be brought back, and handily we can see them today. If we talk a bit about the locations that you visited during your time, because you have a number of videos on your channel, and there is this series on Astley Green and Walkden Railways, which is the Colliery Railway. There's also The Day Stan Left, which is about the paper mill railway. But before that, there's snippets of the end of BR Steam.
Yeah, which is only just the start. I mean, I've got loads of footage of the end of BR Steam. What's kind of a shame, and I'm sorry I didn't continue shooting 8mm film beyond Astley Green, because I didn't. I went 16mm, and then I went into television, and nothing was good enough other than being on 16mm. So I thought, what's the point? And I shot stills after that, because there was steam in the collieries right up until 1984. All I captured was on still film, and I'm sorry I didn't capture more on 8mm. But by that time, I'd kind of ruled out 8mm. It wasn't exhibitionable enough.
Mm.
And who knew that laser graphic scanners were going to come along and YouTube was going to come along as a way of presenting this stuff?
Exactly, and being able to get an audience for it. Because like you say before, it would have been, you'd just be exhibiting it to an audience at home in your living room.
Exactly.
And that's as far as it would go. I mean, think about how much 8mm film there is out there that still hasn't been seen by anyone outside of a small group of people.
Even towards the end of Astley Green and towards the end of Steam, there were hundreds of photographers there, both with still cameras and movie cameras. We've not seen very much of that. We've seen more about the end of Steam on BR, because there were a lot more people there. But some of the shots you can see, especially in the snow scenes towards the end of Astley Green, there are a lot of people around, and they were all taking pictures like I was taking pictures.
Mm. When you would say at your video at Edge Hill Sheds, where you are filming, when you are filming scores of Black Fives and ATEFs coming onto an off shed, getting trains stuck, helping each other out, getting derailed, all sorts of things like that. How many people were around then? How many people had the forethought to be able to get in there and document these things before it was too late?
Well, you've got to remember, it was very expensive to shoot film too, even to shoot black and white, because not only did you have the black and white stills, you had to buy a camera, which would be, a decent camera would be at least £100. Which was a lot of money in those days. I was only earning £5 or £6 a week as an apprentice. Your film stock, then your processing, and then your printing. We're talking, several pounds each time. I was such a nutter that I was prepared to put all my pocket money into that. My dad obviously subbed that as well. But a lot of the guys who were knocking about were collecting numbers. They were train spotters. They weren't taking pictures. The older guys were taking pictures. They would have Rolleiflexes, was a camera, Pentaxes, or I would have loved a Spotmatic Pentax, but that was way above my pay grade at that time. There were a lot of people around shooting 8mm film. Not huge amounts, but there were Manchester Victoria on a sunny afternoon. There may be one or two others, as well as myself there.
As well, there may have been a sense that a sort of panic towards the end that more hadn't been documented earlier when it was so ubiquitous. And there's that feeling of, we better get this before it's too late.
Well, yeah. I mean, the worst thing for me was I was right in the middle of taking my GCSEs when End of Steam happened.
Oh, no.
So I wasn't filming for 3 months. I wasn't going around the railways. And then I took a trip down to Manchester Victoria and there were no bankers there. There was a diesel banker, class 2 diesel banker. I knew the end had happened. So I took a trip up to Newton Heath Shed, and there was nothing in steam. Now, there was still, Carnforth and Lostock Hall still had steam. That was up the Preston area and Carnforth. But yeah, it suddenly disappeared from Manchester. I think it was June or early July.
How did you feel about that at the time?
Oh, gutted. It was, it was a good friend as it was leaving fast. I mean, what was I going to do with all that spare time? What was I going to do with all this camera equipment? Well, my little 8mm and my still camera. No, actually, I didn't have a still. I was still borrowing my dad's still camera at that time. Yeah, I mean, a lot of us discussed, we'd give up photography completely. Railway enthusiasts on the end of the platform waiting for another steam train at Manchester Victoria. What would we do? Where would we spend our spare time? Because I didn't really understand the sort of industrial scene either, that there was quite a lot of interest and there was some magnificent stuff to take pictures of. I hadn't even bothered to think about it until the end of Steam.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people felt the same, that why would you bother going out of your way to a private industrial site when it was on your doorstep anyway?
Yeah, and they were all sort of running up and down a siding. And it wasn't anything like as spectacular or as glorious as the mainline steam was. It didn't have the same charisma about it. It didn't seem to.
Mm.
But a place like Astley Green, you had a good long run of 5 miles or so, and you had these spectacular gradients. And you had banking and three or four steam engines in steam at a time.
Astley Green Colliery, quite a large complex that was bordered on one side by a canal. And the railway line had to get over that canal to get over the height of boats passing underneath it. So quite a few of your videos focus on the bridge that goes over that canal because you get these spectacular performances from these little austerities, really. I mean, they're quite small in terms of locos, but they're big for industrial locomotives. Yeah. And the amazing sight and sound coming out of them.
Well, they were quite happy to thrash them to death. Actually, I never saw one die. Wheels would be thrashing around, sanders on, shuddering, and huge volcanic eruptions from their chimneys. I mean, this was spectacular stuff. There were two ways out of the colliery. The one over the canal bridge was to BR exchange sidings, and then there was a 5 mile run up the hills to Kersley Power Station. So you had two very different routes, because the one to the exchange sidings ran across Chat Moss, which was like a big open moorland area.
Well, Chat Moss famous for, the Liverpool-Manchester Railway had to cross it.
Yeah.
So that was a huge engineering task.
Yeah, at the time. And that's where it joined onto the Manchester-Liverpool main line. Yeah, and they actually used the same process when they laid the line out to the BR exchange siding of putting it onto thatched beds of trees, floating it across the moss. So the colliery, some almost 100 years later, used the same system to get their railway across to the Liverpool-Manchester Railway.
Wow. When we're talking about how the crews are treating the locos, I think for people today who grew up without that kind of thing, I guess the nearest parallel you could say, well, this is just plant. It's just plant equipment. It's the same as, you know, a JCB on a building site. You know, it's there to do a job. And if it's not doing its job, then you have to get something else, or you have to kick its teeth in to make it do the job.
I felt that the crews had a great affection for the steam engines at the same time. They were certainly closer to the steam engines than they were to the diesel locomotives. There's something about a steam engine, the personality of a steam engine, even though it's filthy, dirty work. And when they were running up and down at Astley Green and the wind would blow off Chat Moss, it was bitter in those cabs in the wintertime. They had those, you can see it in the films, they had these sort of canvas drapes on the cab. They're open when you see them on the film, but they used to pull those right across to enclose themselves. It was a pretty miserable job at times, but they loved their steam engines. They definitely did that. There were some crews that didn't, but most of them did, and they found a great satisfaction of working a whole shift and keeping the steam engine going, you know, in terms of steam and fire and leaving it in preparation for the next crew, because these locomotives were a three-shift system, 24 hours a day. They were in steam.
So they're never really getting a break. They're just switching over crews all day, every day. In one of your videos, you mentioned that it was a matter of pride to get as many wagons unassisted over the bridge out of the colliery. Was there a lot of that kind of stuff going on? Like, sort of not rivalry, but a sense of doing a job well and being able to do it without somebody having to help you?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I was too young to really cross-examine the crews about what they were doing. You know, I'd been invited up onto the footplate, but I keep fairly quiet. Also, you couldn't hear each other as well with the sound of the locomotive. But they were befuddled by things like the, as I say in one of the films, by the mud on the road that was spread out over the rail. So there was, just at the bottom of the gradient, on the way back into the colliery, there was a level crossing which the trucks took. And on wet days, it would be a mess. And the engines would have a real problem once they hit that level crossing of slipping, because the wheels would drag the mud up the slope. They were pretty crazy, those crews, in a way. They weren't going to make it up with that massive train. But they tried anyway.
Yes. And I think no doubt that it's two or three attempts to get over the bridge.
Well, there was always a locomotive knocking around the yard. They could whistle up and they'd come and double head the last few yards over the top of the bridge.
That's something that it doesn't feel playful, but I'm trying to find the right word, that you don't really feel that the modern network is that flexible in terms of just getting a mate, just calling a mate over to come and give you a hand.
Well, you don't have the capacity anymore. Mm. Well, two things there. One is there was a lot of redundancy in it. There were three engines in steam knocking about, and that didn't include the engines coming down from Walkden to take the trains up to Kersley. And you had those guys were a law unto themselves. They knew the pattern of work that was needed in the colliery and where the empty wagons needed to go. But I think they were probably pretty difficult to manage.
So you don't envy the foreman's job?
I don't envy the foreman's job, because they could pull the wool over his eyes and pretend they were doing something else when they weren't doing it. But they knew to get the wagons in certain places at certain times. It wasn't quite complete anarchy, but there was a little bit of that.
And also, I guess, in an industrial context, the crews are switching points for themselves. They're not relying on a central controller to be able to tell them where to go.
Yeah, they had a shunter with them. And he was pinning the brakes down and changing the points.
So they're working as a group of three, really.
Well, sometimes the shunter would be the fireman as well. At Astley Green, their engines were pretty modern because they had oblong easel ejectors, chimneys. They were very concerned about the smoke. I talk about that in one of the films.
You travel around quite a lot in your days documenting Astley Green, different locations. How much of an idea did you have of the stories you wanted to tell at the time? Or was it a case of just filming as much as possible?
Yeah, just as much as possible. I mean, who knew? I'd arrive at Astley Green, it may be 3 or 4 weeks since I'd been there. I'd arrive, it might be a Saturday morning, it might be a Saturday afternoon, it could be a Wednesday when we were off college. And I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know how many locos were in steam. Some guys were a little bit more organized than I was. The older guys, they'd know the pattern of work. But I didn't, so I just filmed what was moving.
Mm.
So you've got to remember that 8mm film, you really couldn't edit it. If you tried to edit it, you had these very crude editors, viewers, and crude splicing equipment, and usually you scratch the film up. So I didn't edit I tried it once, and I didn't do it after that. I borrowed someone's equipment. So really, I used to put a screen up in my bedroom and just sit very close to the screen so the picture was as big as possible, and a projector back on a cupboard, and watch these films with pop music turned up. And no one else came into the room when I was doing this. And I just used to sort of imbue myself in this, what my memories were of these steam engines. You've got to remember also there was no sound with it. It was very personal. Those viewing moments were very personal. And really, they weren't going to relate to other people. That was the great step forward with doing The Day Stan Left, was when I was shooting on 16, the picture quality was better and it was easier to exhibit. Plus the fact you had a means of which of editing sound with it. And I'd actually recorded most of the sound was sync on The Day Stan Left, either with my own tape recorder or another friend of mine from university would come down with me and we'd shoot together.
Let's talk a bit about The Day Stan Left, because you do go into this a little bit on the video itself on YouTube when you give the audio commentary on it. This is a film that you intended to exhibit from the start. So rather than documenting, this has almost became your calling card, actually.
Well, it was very much the fact that I could edit the films. So it was going to become a story, definitely a story. It wasn't like just collecting images like the Astley Green stuff was.
And where did the idea for it come from?
Well, again, it was this sort of peculiar railway where it ran from one side of the road to the other. There was no real story there. It was just this peculiar ancient Victorian artifact that was still doing a daily work that was a steam engine. What the hell? I mean, it was a steam engine. It was something I loved. It had a little spectacular gradient here and there. It was a very, very sort of like, it was like the hell, that area.
Satanic mills.
It was absolutely that. It was, there was a transparent papers on one side of the river, and there was YD papers on the other side of the river. There was this river, the River Irwell, that ran in between the two of them, which was absolutely, if you fell into it, you probably wouldn't survive. It was steaming and smoking. And sometimes there was a weir on it, and it would trough up at the weir, and the foam from the weir would blow over Hate Bridge, the village, would blow over in great clouds over the village, because they were using the river to wash the pulp, which is now illegal and all that sort of stuff. Transparent papers gave out the most horrible smells. And in amongst this, and my wife could not understand me at all, that I love these ancient industrial sites that would scare the pants off my kids.
But yeah, I understand that sort of fascination with this.
And very photographic too.
Yeah, yeah. The drama of it all.
Yeah, but not just the steam engine though. These places were dramatic in their own sense, you know, these mills and the dirt and the... If you listen closely in the films, you can hear the slapping of these belted power lines that they used in the factory, because they had a centralized, it was electric motor by that time, but they were line shafts that ran through the mills with these leather belts that went down to the machinery. And you can hear the join in the leather belts click, 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 clicking over the iron rollers.
It would drive you mad these days. Just that kind of incessant, deafening noise, really, like, you know, the ambient noise would be overwhelming. At that point, so this is 1972,
72, 73.
How anachronistic was this feeling at the time?
Pretty much so. I would say my contemporaries really weren't interested in it at all. That was one of the things that, you know, I didn't talk about it much with my with the other guys in the on the same degree course as I was doing, because it was part of industry which we were turning our backs on at that time.
Mm. Especially with you working on the electrical side of things.
Yeah, and the power stations were somewhat modern than that, but they were also pretty filthy. But these were even worse. Yeah, there was this feeling that, you know, terraced houses, dark satanic mills, steam locomotives. This is not the steam enthusiast point of view, but they were all well and true. Let's get rid of them. You know, we're not going to look back.
And then you think it's even stranger when you see photographs or footage of the ones working even into the 80s, so 10 years later, that they were still hanging on to then. And you think about what will the rest of the world look so different at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the thing is that the reason why they hung on for so long is, you know, the mines producing the coal and they were cheap. But when you look, when I look back at my photographs and I look back at what people shot in China in the 1980s and the early 90s with the steam engines there, it's a very similar scene.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that Britain was rather like China was
20 years later. Yeah.
Yeah. There wasn't. There wasn't much difference except for the intervening years.
Yeah. If we bring things forward to the 21st century, and you are getting your original 8mm footage laser scanned, it's coming back to you in good quality. How did you go about turning that raw footage into something that people could enjoy on YouTube?
I don't really think of it like that. I think of it, you know, what am I going to enjoy? As I said to you earlier, most of that footage is just I've taken the flash frames out. There's not much wastage as far as the footage is concerned. And many of the times the sequences go together. I was surprised as anybody that the sequences went together as smoothly as they did.
Because I think what really comes across and what really stood out to me, and one of the main reasons I wanted to get in contact, was because there was this sense of storytelling that you often don't get with footage that comes back from that era. So a lot of it is just stuff going on. But I think the fact that you've added a story element to it, especially I think the first one I watched was the Battle for the Canal Bridge, which is where the story is the two locomotives are trying to get a train over the canal bridge. It's very simple, but the way it's told, I think, really stands out. And how did you approach that?
Two things, really. One, I was going to put my mush on the front of the films and at the end of the films to top and tail it. The second thing was that I was going to I was going to tell the story of that afternoon. I find that's one of the things that lacks a lot in railway stuff on YouTube is a narrative. And the other thing was I was very used to using a narrative in my filmmaking for television. I want to know what's happening. Go, tell me the date. Tell me the time. Tell me where we are. Tell me who's doing it. And, you know, what the engines are, what sort of a day it was. Describe the scene to me. Don't over-describe it so it gets too clogged with the voiceover. But you need that element. You need to make it personal. Mm. And as a consequence of that, you're going to tell a story anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a very simple story. But yeah, you're going to tell a story.
But there is a definite beginning, middle, and end. And I think, especially with that one, is that episode 3, I think, that you feel a great sense of accomplishment when they finally do get the train over the bridge. Spoiler alert. It feels good because you've seen a payoff at the end.
Yeah, and it's it's spectacular too. I mean, we're right there in amongst all the slipping and the smoke and the sand on the rails and the mud and all that noise and the fact that you have to back the train off to have another go at it. So, yeah, there's a sort of visceral quality to it. And I think that visceral quality is something that steam engines give very well and are very easy to photograph in that respect.
Definitely. Can we talk a bit about the importance of sound in that storytelling then? Because you do go to the trouble of mixing sound for your stories. I think a lot of people would either upload it silent. Some people like it that way, as it originally, you know, was silent. But you created soundscapes for these films because they do not have them to begin with.
No.
What's the process for that?
Well, first off, is having the sound. Luckily, I recorded a lot of sound. I didn't get my tape recorder until after Asti Green, so it's other places like Bickershaw and over in Wales in the Pont y Dylas and the Craig Murta that I recorded a lot of the sound. So transferring off those tapes. The other thing is layering the sound. So you've got a sound of a steam. You know, I may be running 10 soundtracks. And there'll be factory sound, background factory sound, which would just be a buzz track. There'll be maybe there'll be some sound of birds, sparrows twittering away. Traffic will be another. There'll be a buzz track of traffic. Then there'll be the steam locomotive, which then needs, you know, it's never going to be in sync with the wheels. So I have to cut every exhaust beat to fit the wheels. Then there's the sound of the wagons and the squealing of the brakes and all that sort of stuff. And there may be more than one steam engine. So there's another track of a steam engine. And then there's the voiceover. So I multi-tracked all of this stuff. And then I go, and then I mix it down. And that's all the great liberation of non-linear editing on your Apple computer that allows you to do that kind of stuff, which was not available before.
Yes. And certainly something that you wouldn't have been able to think about, like you're saying about shooting this stuff just for yourself, just for your own memory, and then actually being able to repurpose it and use it for this kind of storytelling is kind of fantastic.
Yeah, the sound is so important. It really opens the picture right up for you. It's just interesting the way, as we talked about earlier, you get the picture back and it's rather flat and colourless. And then you put it through colour correction. It takes a little bit of time. And that brings the picture to life. It's amazing how different that is when you put when you really work on the colour. And I also use, if the shot is a bit shaky, I'll use a smooth cam software to get rid of the shakes. And then you lay the sound on top of that. And this thing is really, I mean, I'm right there, back in that scene. I mean, it's rather kind of crazy because I can feel and smell Astley Green again when I'm making these films.
It's just the one missing sense, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, the smell.
Yeah.
Definitely. But
in The Day Stan Left, it does feature a narrator, the voice of Stan. So who is the voice of Stan?
That's a good question.
Is it Stan himself? Was Stan a real person?
No.
He's a fictitious invention.
Well, how I worked that was during the filming, I used to visit it quite often. And the driver got more and more irritated with my visits.
And then in the end, you document his work.
Yeah. And I mean, I probably should have been a little bit more diplomatic with him. But anyway, it got to a point where I got kicked off the premises and I wasn't allowed to go back in. But luckily, that was my last shot. That's a whole other story. But so I had this film and I needed the structure to it. So my mate, I sent him in with the tape recorder to talk to the driver about me, ostensibly. He said he was working for BBC local radio. And he went in to talk about this guy who'd come to annoy the driver. And he got him talking. And he talked for, I don't know, an hour or something on tape. It was during his lunch break. And we transcribed all of that and then added to the narrative of it. And then I got an actor in to do the voiceover as the guy himself. Now, the thing is, the sort of twist in it is, Stan isn't the driver. Stan's the shunter. So the driver's looking at the sort of demise of his empire through the eyes of the shunter, who really couldn't care less. He's prepared to go and work for Tesco.
That's great. It's very well put together.
I was, the day I got kicked off, it was just before Christmas. And I'd gone down there and it was evening. I wanted to get some shots of the fire being dropped, sort of at the end. And you see it on the end of the film. And the driver was there and he almost flung the fire out on me because I was so close to the cab. And that, he got really angry about that. So he stormed off and called the security guard on the gate. And I got escorted off escorted out of the premises.
You've got to suffer for your art.
A few days later, I got a letter from the faith mill saying, you can't visit it anymore. You've been an irritant to the driver and spoiled his job and his day off and all that sort of stuff. And I wasn't allowed back.
Aww.
And then after I'd made the film and completed it, I went back to the mill and showed it to them. Took the projector there and the loudspeakers, set it up in their conference room and showed it to them, and they were so miserable.
Really?
They didn't want to be seen like that.
They didn't want to be seen like this dying industry that was coming to the end of its life.
Because not only was the steam engine dying, but it was obvious that the paper mills weren't going to last either.
Yeah.
So it was a sort of a bad reflection that they didn't really want to be involved in. So I was hoping to sell some copies of the film to them, but I didn't get a penny out of them.
Yeah.
Now that's the way they're remembered, through this film.
Well, that's the thing. It's the only thing that lasted. I mean, the locos survive, but the mill's gone.
Yeah, I went back to the mills a couple of 3 years ago to just see what it was like, and it's a recycling scrapyard there now. You can still see the tracks in the concrete where I actually stood when the engine's dipping down into the mills. It was rather poignant, that moment.
Mm.
And the guys had actually seen the video on YouTube, so that they were kind of very receptive of me being there. They wouldn't let me film in the yard itself, but yeah, it was interesting to go back and see how much that whole village has changed. Because that's also, you don't see that in the little clips I've seen, but I also talk about the change of the village because they're knocking down all the terraced houses there.
Yeah. There was a lot of clearance going on in the north in that time.
Huge. Yeah. Now, I mean, the centres of cities were just changing. I remember being in St. Helens, and I'd parked up in St. Helens and I'd gone somewhere. This was in sort of the late 70s, early 80s. And I was walking back to my car and I couldn't figure out where I was. I didn't know which town I was in.
Wow.
Because all those northern towns had started to look the same.
Yeah.
And then I suddenly remembered what I was doing. I wasn't on drugs or anything. I remembered what I was doing and where the car was parked. But I just realized then they were very definitely different before that.
Mm. Yeah. Huge change in such a short space of time as well.
Yeah. You know, I went to Astley Green a few years ago to look at what it looked like now. And man, it's so different. I mean, these places have been massacred.
Is it a nature reserve now?
Well, it's a museum.
Mm.
They preserve one of the winding engines there, but it's there's virtually no evidence of the track. And and one thing that's happened in the intervening years, countrywide, is there's been a great flourishing of trees.
Mm.
Even Chat Moss, which used to be this big open empty space, is all trees, certainly around the Astley Green end of things. So you can't see any distance either. Mm. Whereas in the days when I was there at Astley Green, you could see the distance.
Mm.
And of course, then the other side of it is it's full of little houses.
Yeah, new towns that have sprung up.
Yeah.
Infill between, sort of as the urban spread of the cities get bigger.
Yeah, you know, Walkden Yard, which was a big maintenance area for the National Coal Board, is now a housing estate.
Yeah, it makes sense because, I mean, you're getting these huge ex-industrial sites that are just sitting around doing nothing, and then
it's God knows what the pollution is on that site.
God, no, or even don't dig a pond.
yeah, exactly. They're, you know, and also they try to avoid it, but I've noticed some houses go over the tops of mine shafts.
Mm.
That's a bit dodgy.
Yeah. I think we're finding that out. I think one of the houses that I used to live in Bedminster and Bristol, I think was almost certainly falling into an old mine. There's a huge crack down the middle of it. With the sound, I think it's almost like good visual effects or good special effects in that if you've done it right, people almost don't notice and it becomes part of the experience. They don't. If someone comes back to you and says, oh, I like the effect, it means kind of like you didn't do it properly because they saw it. The sound is almost like they should just feel like it's meant to be there. And I think that's what really comes across well.
Yeah, I get people asking me, say, how did you record that sound at the same time? Is it actually sync sound? I don't answer those ones.
Now we've got the exclusive reveal on the Railway Mania podcast. Excellent. It's one of those things, I think, that made the experience feel like a time machine, almost. It feels like, the first time I watched those films, it felt like someone had just gone back in time with almost modern equipment or modern filmmaking abilities with the idea of making it in a non-linear editor and gone and shot these films. I think that was really set it apart from a lot of other films at the time. And also the fact that at the time you released them on YouTube, not many people were doing this kind of film to digital transformation. A lot of the stuff that's around has gone through being a VHS. And then God, so the quality is appalling.
Mm.
And you know, now people don't have DVD players that much anymore. They don't have VHS players. A lot of it is just being seen online. So I think a lot of the stuff that's available to people is actually of worse quality than when it started. And I think this helps bring it back to this idea that, well, actually, the quality was always there. It's just been hidden.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real shame that an 8mm camera onto 8mm film, it was a little bit like a lot of them were point-and-shoot cameras. You didn't have to think an awful lot about it. All that stuff at Astley Green was shot with automatic iris on the camera, automatic exposure on the camera.
This is the equivalent of whipping your phone out now and just taking a clip.
Exactly. I mean, it had a sort of crude focusing thing. Most of the time, I'd get it the wrong way anyway. So I try not to use the focus. So it was 8mm film, and the cameras that were available then were actually, if they transferred it properly and it wasn't too scratched, that film would look really nice. The only problem is it costs.
Mm. So when you say the cost, you mean the cost of transferring it?
Transferring it to digital, yeah.
Mm.
And that laser graphic, I think it was like 43 cents a foot. So you got 1,000 feet, that's that's $400,
mm.
$450.
I wonder if a lot of the film archives or the publishers of people who sold all those VHSs in the 80s and 90s, perhaps they feel reluctant to convert everything again because they've already shelled out for all of that, converting it to VHS in the first place.
I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I see stuff that's been pirated, a lot of VHSs of Steam in the 1960s. I think the thing is that a lot of those publishers have probably gone to the wall now.
Maybe.
So
you wonder what happened to the original footage then?
Well, hopefully it went back to the person who shot it.
Mm.
But again, there's some wonderful stuff I've watched on, especially on Southern Region, which I wasn't very familiar with the Bulliard Pacifics, which would look so great if they had remastered it.
Mm.
Mind you, I'm not putting myself up to put the money up to remaster this stuff, but it would look fantastic. Sometimes these guys did actually record sound at the same time, if you get hold of them. But you see, they're all pretty old. I'm pretty old, you know. Now when that cascades down into the next generation, are they interested in it? Is it just something filling a shelf?
What I hope is that people who have access to this kind of footage see the kind of stuff that you've been making and see what can be made from it and how good it can look and how what the reaction is to it. Because obviously, that's one of the great things about online publishing now is that you can get a reaction from people and you can get a conversation going about stuff, and that they decide to bite the bullet as well. There's somebody else on YouTube, I think it's the Ken Elwood Archive, who started to digitize some old film in a similar way. It's not quite the same sort of production value, but it's really good footage and high definition stuff too.
This is a 16mm from his dad, isn't it?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Settle Carlisle line.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, funnily enough, I did. I thought he'd done a good job with the transfer, so I because I'm not in the US anymore, so I don't have access to the guy with the laser graphic. Where he got that transfer, and there's a little shop up in Cheshire, just south of Crewe, which does those transfers. So that's the next thing on my list is I'm actually going to send some footage up to them and see what their transfer is actually like, especially off 8mm. And I have, as you see around my office, tens of thousands of feet of 16mm from trains I've shot, which hasn't been seen. Which I'd love to get transferred and sort of build up a whole. I mean, I could run my channel probably for the next 100 years with the stuff I've got.
Do you have enough time to edit it all?
Probably not. No. Well, I mean, that's the other thing is I'm not. I don't want to create a rod for my back. I mean, a lot of YouTubers talk about feeling this anxiety because they've got to get another film out this week, yeah. Or they're going to lose their audience.
So it's certainly in our line of work, we've seen it all. Like you have a lot of people who exist in a state of not quite being popular enough, but being too popular. So there's the nether zone in the middle, and when you occupy that zone, you're under so much pressure to meet deadlines and expectations and things, but it never quite grows beyond that, so you can take your hands off the wheel a little bit. And I think a lot of people, what's really sad about that is you lose sight of the enjoyment of it. Like, why are you doing it in the first place?
That's right.
And it's got to be enjoyable.
That's right. And the other thing is it's a lonely business, because most YouTubers are doing it on their own, and they're not seeing people day in and day out. I mean, I found that too. That was interesting when, much later on in my career, in the 2010s and beyond, when I was doing commercials, shooting commercials, we'd audition online for the commercial. I'd probably see the agency a couple of times before the shoot. We'd audition. I'd send the auditions up to the agency. They'd do the picks. I'd see the agency on the shoot. But everything after that was all online. I mean, even the voiceover was, the guy could be in Chicago. I was down just north of Boston.
We pretty much exclusively do voiceovers over high speed links now.
Yeah, the rough cut and the fine cuts I'd be uploading to the client online, and then they'd send me an email back with what they wanted to cut. So that it was going that way anyway.
Mm.
To be a lonely business filmmaking.
Mm. Yeah, which in a way has diversified. And democratize the ability to make films for a lot of people, but at the same time, it does mean you're competing with more people.
Yeah, I mean, are you really competing with people? Because there's so much, there's so many consumers. I'm amazed at people who you'd have thought would have found your channel because they're train enthusiasts, steam locomotive enthusiasts, but they've only just found your channel.
Yeah, so you have so now done 9 in the Astley Green series alone, and you're still getting comments saying, oh, I've literally just stumbled across this. And you think, well, it's been around for a few years now.
Yeah, and there's still, you know, I'm getting on the earlier films, not just the Astley Green, but also on just building model steam trains, I'm getting 20 or 30 hits a day on those. So I'm making up across 73 films. I'm getting around about 800 hits a day to 1,000 hits a day. If I put a video out, I get a lot more hits, and then it trails off. Mm. But if I'm not putting any videos out, I'm getting that number of hits.
Mm.
And the other thing is that I notice on like the big hitters, the one about Out and About with Russell, which I got 750,000, people actually stay on it a lot less time.
Yeah.
So the average is like 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
But on the lower ones, the ones with lower viewage, people are on for 5 minutes.
So that's your dedicated audience there.
Yeah, you're hitting much more the right audience. The algorithm's going to the right people.
Yeah, I think I may have contributed to that quite a lot because I have watched them quite a lot of times.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
Yeah, I mean, they make great. When you're modeling something on your desk, it's great, like to have on your laptop next to you.
Oh, nice!
You know, that's what I want to achieve with this model.
Well, I think what I've always aimed for is high production value. I don't think there's any point in putting something out if you're not putting it out to the highest production value that you can put it out at. I think there's a lot of stuff goes out and it's dross, and you're undermining your audience, and you're undermining the faith in your audience, and you're undermining the longevity of the product. There are pressures on people. I'm not looking to my YouTube channel as being my form of income. I do get paid. They are monetized, but it's not my form of income. So it gives me a certain amount of relaxation in what and when. Like summertime now, I don't want to be in front of my computer editing. I want to be out and about. I want to be in the garden. I want to be playing trains. When I go to a club, a new club with my steam engine, I don't have to be messing around with a camera.
I certainly found when I was documenting events is that you can either enjoy the event or you can document it.
Right.
One or the other. You can't do both. And unless you're enjoying the actual documentation process and you're not stressing about what shots you're getting, have you got enough coverage and everything, that it just turns into a chore.
Absolutely. And especially when there are people about too. Mm. You know, you've got to take into account there's a whole load of other people around that not only you're interfering with, but if you're running a steam locomotive, you've got to be aware of them being there. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the camera. I was lucky in the States when I had my own garden railway that I could just indulge myself and film it, you know, when I wanted to, and it was just me and the train. But here I'm going to public tracks, and I've got to take into account. I've got to take into account some people don't want to be filmed.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when you make a mistake.
Yeah, you can't hide it quite so much, can you?
Yeah, absolutely. You've touched on this a little bit, but can you tell us a bit about what are you planning to make next using your vast resources of film that you have?
I mean, that's a good question because, there's no rhyme or rhythm in the algorithms. I can make a film about my little steam engine, and it'll get a really high set of views. It'll get a lot of views. And then I'll make a very, not very similar, but of one of my other steam engines doing not so differently, and a description about what it's doing. And I get, you know, rather than 100,000 views, I get 2,000 views, which is very good. Mm. Some of the Astley Green ones have been real slow burners.
Mm.
You know, they've sort of rumbled up to like 1,500, and then they then slowly built up to 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000.
I guess the hope with those is that if somebody sees one and they see that it's part of a series, they might go back and see the others.
Well, that's what happens. That definitely what happens. But there's no rhyme or reason in the way the algorithm. You know, what on my channel, what subject works the best? Is it running my gas mechanical? Is it running my simplex engine? Is it Astley Green? Is it going to be British Rail? Railways, end of steam. I don't know. So it doesn't really matter.
And I think,
as long as I keep it to those kind of subjects, I mean, I can't start making jewellery.
Right. Yeah. Unless it's train themed jewellery, I guess, which would be a bit niche. I don't know. Maybe there's a market there. With view counts as well, I think it's another place where you can get snowblind. And I think what's really important is to take yourself back a bit and think, say, for example, your video's got 200 views. 200 people. Imagine seeing them all in a room together. It's like, they've all watched your video. Like, yeah. And to say that, well, that's actually amazing. So if you are a video creator on YouTube and you're beating yourself up that something didn't perform quite as well as the previous one, maybe just think about the people that did enjoy it and how amazing that is that you were able to make something that you know, people did like. And I used to get hung up on, I still do to a certain extent, on dislikes or bad comments and things like that. And say, well, why did this person hide all my videos? Why did this person block my channel? Because you can get that in the little analytics readouts. Like, what did I do to offend them? You know, I mean, it's really important to put that in perspective against the amount of good stuff that's going on there. Because I think broadly, people have been very supportive.
I found people very supportive, and I've noticed it on your channel too. That, you know, people take the time out to write and thank you.
Yeah, which is amazing.
That is amazing,
and it makes me think about the amount of times that I've enjoyed a video and not commented.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. That I really should do more of. So that's my resolution now. Is to,
because it does. You know, it does help you as a content. Actually, I hate the word content. As a filmmaker.
Content creator.
Ah, I mean that was when it all went to pieces. Really, wasn't it?
That's my industry.
Yeah. When someone gives you encouragement, it's really nice to get, nice to have. Mm. I mean, obviously, when you get likes, it's really nice to have that. When you get the subscribers, you see those slowly building up.
Yeah,
I think you've got to be very circumspect with the whole thing. I mean, the one thing is my channel is not controversial in any way whatsoever. Mm. So I'm not treading a political line, no, or a political message or whatever. I'm enjoying steam trains.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about hobbies is that it's so accessible.
Yeah.
You know, we can have lots of different people. Every different type of person can be into trains. Like, there's no barrier to being into
it. I've heard trains as a hobby is the second biggest hobby in the UK. Gardening is the first biggest hobby, and trains is the second biggest hobby.
So garden railways,
yeah,
could link the two.
But that's when I say that's everything from N gauge to full size trains.
Why do you think that is? Why this fascination with trains? And let's say it's pretty obvious, steam engines in general. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think they're an art form. I think they're like an art installation, especially now that we don't use them as a practical purposes anymore. They are so beautiful. I mean, you look at a steam locomotive and you look at the valve gear on a steam locomotive and the way it performs and the way it swings around each other. And you look at the sort of proportions. You know, the crazy thing is the cab's at the back.
Mm.
I mean, where is the worst position you could put a place to put the driver?
Yeah, it's like imagine trying to drive a lorry from the back of the lorry.
Exactly. Looking along this long boiler. But it seems to be in proportion.
Mm.
And, you know, a tank engine is again a beautifully proportioned thing, and it's sort of chunky and it's sort of friendly. And then you've got a mainline steam engine looks very nude without its tender.
Mm.
The tender seems to balance it up, even though the tender is really a dead weight and a very inefficient thing. But it seems to balance it all. So I see them as, and then you've got the smoke, and then you've got the interaction with the smoke as it swirls around as it goes past you, and then you've got the noise, very much like an art installation.
And I think it's a cliche, but it's that elemental feeling of, you know, combining fire, air, water all together, making motion.
Absolutely.
And converting rock into power. It's something very special, I think.
And the other thing that's very special is the fact it takes so long to fire a steam engine up. You know, mainline steam engine, they take half a day to get the fires back into and get any pressure on the boiler. After a run, and then you've got to oil it all around because it's a constant loss lubrication system. And then at the end of the run, you've got a clinkered fire, you've got to empty the ash pan, you've got to empty the smoke box. It's a filthy, dirty job. Take an hour or so to do that, to put the engine away. And then every 2 weeks, you've got to wash the boiler out, which takes a whole day to wash the boiler out and scrub the tubes. It's crazy. It's nuts.
Yeah, the amount of time you have to devote to this machine.
Yeah, and tender.
And people think that classic cars are bad, but it's just on another
nothing
level.
Nothing like it. And although they look big and strong, steam locomotives are really fragile pieces of kit. They would, piston rings had to be changed between 20 and 30,000 miles. Could you imagine if it was like that on a car? When they put the Britannias into the Liverpool Street to Norwich run, when they were brand new, they were only getting 10,000 miles and less out of the piston rings on those things. And it was like, oh, that's just all right. You know, we've got the fitters to do it. We've got to take the thing, the cylinder covers off. We've got to pop the pistons out. We've got to put these bloody... They just did it.
Mm. And that infrastructure to support it and constant maintenance regime.
And it was really bad design.
Yeah, I guess so.
But it was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's just beauty and inefficiency, I guess. Well, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? That the better something becomes at its task, a lot of people talk about soul and things like that. I guess this is why people like Alfa Romeos, because apparently they have soul, when in fact I think they're kind of just bad at their job. But you know, I think maybe there's a parallel. Yeah, maybe that is a parallel with the steam locomotive there.
But I mean, it is. It's an interesting parallel because Alfa Romeos were great performers. Sometimes they had really good engines in them that made a nice noise, but they were clapped out after a few thousand miles.
If you don't stay on top of the maintenance, then that's it.
You've lost a whole load of Alfa Romeo enthusiasts.
Yes. Sorry, Alfa Romeo.
We didn't mean it.
Sorry. Do you know roughly what the immediate future holds? What do you plan to do next?
Well, the next film is Trainspotting at Mansion of Victoria.
Oh, fantastic.
I sort of look at myself as being the original vlogger, because I did actually shoot myself by holding the camera out on the end of my arm.
Whoa.
As I walked through these places. Before the selfie stick.
Wow. So it's your fault.
Well, no one's seen it yet. It's about to come on. So the whole thing of going through the ticket barrier with your threepenny platform ticket, and the guy would always question you whether you were actually going to meet someone off a train.
Nah.
And you'd have to persuade him to allow you in. But once you were in onto the through platforms, then the whole world of steam trains would open up. And you'd spend the rest of the day there.
Yeah.
Occasionally, you'd get on a train and go out to Dean Lane, which was then into Newton Heath Engine Shed, and spend the afternoon maybe at Newton Heath. Or if you were really feeling frisky, you'd get a ticket up to Bolton Shed, which was another big steam shed, or out to Edgeley Shed, which was in Stockport, which was another Edgeley and Heaton Mersey in Stockport, which are another big shed. Great thing about, and I've got that coming up in some films, is at Edgeley, Saturday afternoon, You were guaranteed a big oil train coming in from Liverpool, and they were double-headed by 2 9Fs on the front.
Wow.
And the crew changed at Edgeley Shed. So they'd come to a halt at Edgeley. They wouldn't take water on, but they'd be there probably about half an hour while they changed crews, and then they'd leave. And this was spectacular stuff. I just wish I'd not only caught them, and I filmed these at Edgeley, the crew changes, but I just wish I'd seen them going over the Pennines, over to Leeds. Because going up through, is it Stanhope or somewhere like that? It would have been spectacular, those 2 9Fs. And I've not seen any footage of that anywhere, the 9Fs going over the Pennines.
Mm.
There were over 1,000 ton, those trains.
I think I've seen stuff of them in later years. I don't know if it's the same train or not, but where they would put a 9F inside the diesel. So they put the diesel on the front and then put the 9F behind it.
Yeah, that was towards the end they did that.
Yeah. And what year were you down at Manchester Victoria?
Oh, from 66.
Okay.
Through to 68.
Just predates the Astley Green stuff, because obviously that's after the end of steam.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before your interest shifted over.
Yeah, there's a beautiful picture. I have it on my desktop. I didn't take it, but it's of one of the Liverpool sheds. Not Speak, it was the other one. Oh, Birkenhead. And there's a row of 9Fs. These were working the oil trains at that time, and they're in for maintenance. And there's one 9F after another heading back into the shed. And there's a group of guys with the smoke box door open. They're obviously dealing with probably cleaning the tubes or doing something in the superheater elements in the smoke box. And it's a fantastic picture. Again, I wish I'd visited Birkenhead when the 9Fs were ruling there.
Well, I think we'd be extremely grateful for the stuff you did manage to capture.
Well, thanks.
And I really look forward to seeing more on your channel.
Yeah, I look forward to putting it out too.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure talking.
Thanks a lot, Kerwin. Good to talk to you.
And we'll look forward to more soon.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Yes. Thanks everyone for listening. I hope this was as interesting and insightful for you as it was for me. And thanks especially to Jonathan for being an excellent guest. Be sure to check out his YouTube channel, Gandhi Dancer Productions, for more excellent films. If you like the Railway Mania podcast, then please do give us a review on any podcasting app that you use. It really helps get the word out there to fellow enthusiasts who may also enjoy listening. Bye for now.